New York State is about to have its first experience with early voting. What's working? What's not? And what will this mean for election results? We'll have an in-depth look at the state's first attempt. We'll also have analysis of this week's headlines with Reporters Roundtable host Casey Seiler of the Times Union, Karen DeWitt of New York Public Radio, and Michael Gormley of Newsday. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Welcome to New York Now. I'm Ray Suarez. Here's a look at the latest headlines out of Albany. Governor Andrew Cuomo says he's leaning toward an April special election to fill the seat of the disgraced former Republican Congressman Chris Collins, who resigned last month after pleading guilty to insider trading. The April special election would coincide with the state's presidential primary. The state Senate held a public hearing in Albany this week as it considers reforming a state law that bars the release of disciplinary records for a range of public safety workers, most notably police. Democratic state lawmakers have introduced a bill that would give New Yorkers an option to donate to an abortion access fund when they file their taxes. The bill's sponsors, State Senator Alessandra Biaggi and Assemblywoman Karina Reyes, both from the Bronx, say the fund's intended to make abortion care more accessible for women. And early voting begins in New York. The voting period begins October 26th and runs through November 3rd. With me now is Casey Seiler of the Times Union. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Ray.
What else happened in Albany this week?
Well, the governor is getting very tough with National Grid, a utility, very large utility in New York State, that has said that it is having a hard time doing natural gas hookups in New York because of the lack of pipeline capacity running downstate. In addition to that, there was some controversy over a apparent policy shift by the state-appointed panel that is looking at the establishment of a new system of publicly financed campaigns.
We'll hear from you on all these topics during the Reporters Roundtable coming up later in the show. Let's move to early voting. It's New York's first try. How's it going so far?
Well, that really remains to be seen. This weekend, as you noted, begins the process. It runs for 9 days, ending on the Sunday before Election Day. This was part of the package of election reforms that was passed in the Assembly, which has passed them in a number of previous years, and the newly democratically controlled state Senate. The GOP in the Senate objected somewhat to the process. They said that the bill might have been rushed through, and there was some concern over the cost of the measure. But in the end, almost half of the Senate Republican conference voted in favor of the measure.
Is it an expensive thing to do, to open up polling places well before Election Day?
Many of the municipalities have expressed concerns about that. The cost is expected to be about $7 million. Now, Democrats point out that that cost will be covered, and more so, by the $25 million that the state is expected to save by combining the congressional primary dates and the legislative primary dates, the first in June. The second used to be in September. Now they're both going to be in late June.
Now, it makes sense to do it in what is the most off-year of off-year
Yes.
elections. It gives us a chance to sort of see what doesn't go right before a really big election next year, right?
Exactly. As you noted, almost all of this year's elections in New York State are, you know, municipal, you know, mayors, county legislature, that kind of thing. Next year is, of course, much bigger. We not only have the presidential primary, we have the aforementioned, you know, joint primary date, and, of course, an election day that will include a presidential election, all the legislative races, all the congressional races as well.
Casey, thanks a lot. We'll check back with you later in the program.
My pleasure.
For more news analysis. Let's take a deeper look now at early voting in New York. Not all counties have had an easy time setting it up. We'll look at how one county upstate, Rensselaer County, ran into a bit of contention in rolling out the new law.
The city of Troy in Rensselaer County is home to just under 50,000 people. That's more than a third of the population of the entire county. During New York's early voting period that runs from October 26th through November 3rd, there will not be a polling place in Troy. In the late 19th century into the early 20th, Troy was one of the largest cities in the country. With 75,000 people, the collar city was booming with industry and brimming with wealth. Today, 26% of Troy lives below the poverty line. The majority of the county's minority and student voters reside in the city. Those facts have Democratic City Council member David Bissember questioning the county's decision not to put an early voting place there.
72% of the population of the entire county who does not have access to a personal vehicle reside in the city of Troy. And so when you establish voting sites outside of the city of Troy, that means a lot of the people who this law was intended to help support will not have easy access to the polls because they rely on public transportation, buses, and it's disproportionately impacting residents who are most likely to need early voting access.
The Rensselaer County Board of Elections chose two sites for its early polling places in May, and both were outside city limits and largely inaccessible by public transportation. In response, David Bissember led a bipartisan push backed by the city council to get a polling place in Troy.
It was really something that we all worked on together to introduce a piece of legislation which would cover half the costs to establish a voting site in the city of Troy. That was our first piece of legislation which we passed in a bipartisan effort and was supported by the administration as well.
But the Republican-dominated county legislature voted down three of the city council's appeals. Jason Schofield is the Republican commissioner for the County Board of Elections. He says the polling place choice came down to availability and accessibility.
Well, the county office building is a great spot. However, it's got the motor vehicle department, the aging department, the one-stop unemployment center, which people from all counties come to use. So parking can get very difficult there, as well as spacing. We use it on election day, but the county building's closed. So then we talked about, well, we want to be in this area of the town, the county. How about the next town over was Brunswick? Then we could accommodate the people of Troy, Brunswick, Pittstown, Scaghtikoke, Berlin, Hoosick, Grafton, and Petersburg.
Schofield says while the county is prepared for early voting, they do not know what to expect with turnout.
I think a lot of people are creatures of habit. And a lot of people I've talked to in Troy, they're going to vote on election day because that's what they've always done and what they know how to do. So it'll be interesting to see.
Lawmakers approved early voting this year after Governor Andrew Cuomo pushed for it in his budget proposal.
Let's pass a democracy agenda, talk about voter disenfranchisement.
It hasn't been an easy initiation. Counties across the state have had issues leading up to the early voting period. Some counties, like Albany, have had to limit the number of polling places they offer due to the fact that their polling records are still on paper and can't easily be transferred between polling sites. New York City residents voiced concern over potential security risks associated with placing a polling place at a school during a school day. Many large rural counties struggled to find a polling place that was within a reasonable distance for all residents, and some counties blamed the difficulty on the late payment of the promised $10 million from the state to help cover the costs. Democratic State Senator Neil Breslin represents Troy.
I was very excited to be a co-sponsor.
Breslin has introduced legislation that would require counties to place at least one of its early polling places in the county's most populous municipality.
It does not enhance democracy by preventing certain groups of people from voting.
That would require the Rensselaer County Board of Elections to put early voting polling places in Troy.
What do you hope happens for next year?
I want more people voting, more people participating, and I want them to look at legislation and saying, yes, we've risen to this level, but we can still do more and look for other ways to increase voting.
For now, Democratic Troy City Council member Anasha Cummings is concerned with getting voters access to the early voting sites. He's organizing a group of volunteers to drive people to the polls in Skodak and Brunswick throughout the early voting period.
Every time we talk to people at the doors, we ask them whether they are interested in voting early. And if they are, yeah, we've got a group of volunteers that have cars or vans and are able to drive people out to the closest polling location, which would be a 15-minute drive out Hoosick Street. But we'll make it fun, hang out together in the car and go vote.
City Council President Carmela Mantello, who's a Republican, also supports an early voting site in Troy.
For me, personally, I'm going to vote on November 5th for the mere fact that I want to vote in Troy. And I don't want to go to Brunswick or go to Skodak to early vote.
Meanwhile, Anasha Cummings plans to be the first in line to vote early.
Absolutely, we'll vote. I'll probably vote the first day.
New York's first foray into early voting has been far from smooth. Whether the state and counties can iron out the issues in time for the 2020 election, when voting rights will likely be a big issue, remains to be seen.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. It's good to be at the Reporters Roundtable with my friends Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio and Mike Gormley from Newsday. Thanks very much for coming in.
Sure.
All right, so the governor is going to war with National Grid, specifically on the question of whether or not that large and very powerful utility is wrongfully withholding natural gas hookups, particularly in Newsday's neck of the woods, Long Island.
Right. The governor is actually in a political as well as an environmental bind on this thing. National Grid wants this pipeline through New York Harbor. The governor, being a Democrat and wanting to appeal to progressive voters, doesn't really want to be the governor who allows another fossil fuel pipeline to be hooked up through the harbor. So National Grid is saying that we don't have enough power for natural gas. We can't do these hookups. The governor's saying you have to do these hookups because that's part of your job, is your license. The governor is telling the Public Service Commission, which most of his appointees run anyway, that they have to be much tougher on the utilities.
Yeah, he wrote a very nastily worded letter saying National Grid is incompetent, practically that they're running a scam. It's not true. They have the power. They're just withholding it for strategic purposes, and they should lose their license. I mean, one of the issues in this country is we do have these utilities who are monopolies. So the question is, if you want to replace them, is there anybody else who's even going to come in and do this job, especially when it does seem like there actually is a shortage of natural gas, and they probably do need these pipelines. I mean, everybody talks about wind power and solar power and how much they would like to have that, but we're really not there yet. So unless everybody started using less gas, like homeowners and businesses, I think that they probably do need some pipelines unless they really ramp up the other stuff. So I think that's what we're sort of in the crux in right now. But the governor's decided, maybe it's better to have a fight with National Grid because nobody likes the utilities. So you might as well, go after them, right?
This is not happening in isolation, as you point out. There are other pipeline projects. Mm-hmm. The state and the federal government are battling over a proposed pipeline that would run essentially through the Southern Tier here into the Capital mm-hmm. Region. The governor says that one possibility that the PSC could look at is appointing a monitor, to look at National Grid's operations.
Mm-hmm. But well, the PSC already is a monitor.
That's
right?
True, too.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe they probably should look into it in case National Grid isn't telling the truth. But it just does seem like, you're going to still need natural gas. Nobody really wants that to be the case, but it kind of seems like it is.
The governor's done this before, of course. If you remember back with Superstorm Sandy, he took on the utilities then, created a big problem, called them terrible, terrible names. And ultimately, there was a decision that seems to have worked a bit. We're looking at the same thing here. There's going to be a lot of heated rhetoric going into this, and then some kind of an agreement, probably through the PSC, the Public Service Commission. But again, as Karen said, that's what the Public Service Commission is supposed to do.
And he did the same thing with Spectrum Cable.
That's right.
I would
yeah,
mention
Charter.
Where he was Charter Communications. He was trying to kick them out of the state because they weren't hooking up enough people in rural areas. And they managed to settle that. So he likes to play hardball
this
tactics. We know that.
This
and
game
then,
of chicken will continue.
Yeah,
but
and, sometimes it works.
You don't lose a lot of votes by taking on utilities.
That's right. Nobody likes them.
We are now about a month away. Because the day before Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. we've recently learned, is going to be the date that the Public Finance Campaign Commission, which is charged with coming up with essentially the blueprint for what would be a publicly funded system of campaigns, is going to put out their report the day before
Thanksgiving. Yeah, they know everybody's going to enjoy reading it with their Thanksgiving
right.
dinner. They want maximum attention for this,
no,
right?
No, it's a very festive commission. Because they also had a hearing on Columbus Day, and
that's
then they
right.
announced their members on the day before 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
All very low news days. You know.
All right, that's so right. there. Yes. But this week there was an even odder episode in which the commission approved rules that would allow for out-of-district contributions to be matched by a multiple of public funds. And then a couple of days later, they took another vote and they barred that type of matching.
Yeah, it's hard to figure out what's going on with this commission. They're having, to their credit, a bunch of public hearings. This one was on Long Island this week. A guy, an Uber driver from Nassau County, got up and said, you know, the people I'm talking to feel disenfranchised. How about just multiplying or giving a lot more public financing, state financing, to match contributions from within a legislative district? And Jay Jacobs, who is the state Democratic chair and who's also on the commission, said that that was a genius idea. So now what they voted to do was to do a computer model to see if this works. And I don't know what's going to end up.
But I don't think that exactly came out of nowhere, because one of the commissioners, an experienced election law lawyer, Henry Berger, apparently sent an email to other commissioners suggesting this idea mm-hmm. over the weekend. So it didn't. It seemed like in the meeting it came out of nowhere, but it seemed like maybe this was in the works.
The idea of trying to emphasize this, the whole point of this would be to make contributions by constituents, the candidates trying to represent, count for a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not beholden to contributors from outside the district. The idea has been kicked around for years at different parts, but it's never really been done in a big way. If they do this, that would be major. But again, I'll wait to see what happens, because we're not sure where the commission's going on this.
Yeah, it would also give state parties more control, because they could still get practically unlimited donations and they could funnel it to favored candidates, which in this case would probably be the incumbents who've been there for a long time. So it actually could disadvantage challengers. That's what the advocates for public campaign finance are saying, that this is, there's actually something underhanded in this, and that it's going to actually discourage people from using the system if they can only get money from in the district and they can't get matching funds from out of the district.
You mentioned that Jay Jacobs said, oh, the idea of advantaging in-district contributions is a genius idea.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Jacobs is, of course, the chair of
That's
the
right.
state Democratic Committee
yes.
and is seen by many people. He's an appointee of the governor. He is seen very much as being kind of the mouth of the governor on the commission, I think.
Right.
That's
as Karen brings up, there's a potential, if you look at this, that this would benefit those who are already in office and those who are running the major campaigns, which is also the criticism of this commission as they consider ending fusion voting,
mm-hmm.
which allows minor parties to have a lot of influence in candidates. So if you're looking for a theme, that could be a concerning theme.
And the fact that they're going to release it Thanksgiving Eve
yes.
just doesn't bode well for the people who want a system more like New York City's, which is kind of a more fair system, you know, largely applauded. So it just seems like they might be up to something if they're going to do it on that date.
Speaking
so we'll
of,
find out. Mike and I are going to be reporting on it.
Excellent.
But maybe
Speaking
not on
of,
Thanksgiving Day.
No, I hope not. Enjoy your cranberry sauce. Speaking right. of transparency, there was another hearing into potential reforms to a state law known as 50A, little known but has a large impact, especially for journalists. And it is a law that essentially bars the release of most police disciplinary records.
Right. I would say that this has a great effect on the general public. Right now, you can't really get these disciplinary records on police. So why would you want disciplinary records? It's not to get Social Security numbers and all of police. What it is try to find patterns. If you get all the disciplinary hearings and you get who was brought in on a case, the Eric Garner case, who died in what was called a chokehold by police, there were on the video that we saw from the cell phone video, many, many police officers there, none of whom, very few of whom, were actually brought up and faced any kind of public scrutiny, as far as we know. So this is, I would argue too, that this would be a long-term benefit for the police if they do this, because there is a credibility problem for a lot of people, particularly in lower income neighborhoods, of police. And if there's this kind of transparency, as you say, it would strengthen the role of police because, you know, as far as we know, and I think we all want to believe, in the vast majority of cases, police are acting appropriately. But the disciplinary hiding those or making those secret, those disciplinary reports, is a problem.
I don't think the police are exactly seeing it that way, though. Nobody wants to give out information unless they have to. But, yeah, I agree with you. It seems like probably in the long run, the more the disclosure, it will be better, especially for the cops, the large majority of them that do behave themselves and don't do anything wrong.
Chuck Schumer in the U.S. Senate took advantage of something of a procedural loophole in an attempt to revive the more robust federal deduction for state and local taxes known as the SALT deduction.
That's right, which hurts blue states and helps red states. It didn't succeed because I just don't think he's going to get red state senators to side with him on this. It just seems like they keep beating this issue. But for now, unless there's a big change, if Democrats take over the Senate, have a Democratic president, it seems like we've lost those deductions for now.
And President Trump's position on this and the Republican Senate's position on this is that it's not red state versus blue state, although in actuality that's how it turns out. It's hurting states that have high taxation and high salaried people, and that is New York, it's Massachusetts, New Jersey, all these states, because it limits how much you can deduct from your federal income tax. Result is you pay more federal income tax.
The specific thing that Schumer was trying to address was a ruling from the IRS that said that workarounds that several blue states had come up with, including New York, where basically you could say that your property taxes were charitable donations.
That's right, and then you get a tax credit for
that. It seemed a little
bit
fishy to begin with.
Yeah, they were very excited about that a couple of years ago, and I think some municipalities, probably Long Island, right, set them up.
Yeah,
but I don't know how many people participated in that.
There were more than actually I expected because of it was such an iffy thing. But, you know, the idea of going betting on the IRS being flexible isn't a good bet.
Probably not.
The governor hinted that the special election to replace House Republican Chris Collins, who, of course, left office after pleading guilty to federal insider trading felonies, is likely to come in April, where it will overlap with primary season.
That's right. And it's going to be the presidential primary, and it's a Democratic presidential primary. So if it were to be on April 28th, it would benefit Democrats to maybe take that seat back. It's the most heavily Republican congressional district in the state.
Western New York, the Buffalo area.
Yes. So it would give Democrats a bit of a leg up. Of course, the Republican Party chair, Nick Langworthy, has said that would be terrible. It's unfair. You need to have a special election standing on its own because Republicans aren't going to come out if there isn't a Republican presidential primary. So I think he has a point there with that. But the governor, he hasn't committed yet, but any time that he's asked about it or talks about it, he's leaning toward April 28th, saying, well, you don't want to spend another $1 million for a primary. Who wants to waste the money? But it would be a chance for maybe Democrats to take that seat back from the Republicans.
And the governor, who's the head of the state Democratic committee, the state Democratic Party, really, when he hints that he might be doing something, generally that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, fair to say.
He's laying it out, seeing what people say. But yeah, he hasn't mentioned any other dates.
And 6 months seems like kind of a long way off. Not that there's anything big happening in the U.S. House right now, I guess. Meanwhile, the ongoing battle between a woman named Kat Sullivan, who is the victim of an alleged rape at a private school in the Capital Region, who became a strong advocate for the Child Victims Act. She has been targeted for investigation by the State Joint Commission on Public Ethics. She pushed back this week, announcing she was going to sue that body.
Yeah, and she did receive a settlement in that case, and she used the money to advocate for the Child Victims Act.
In her assault case with the public school.
She put up billboards. She at one point had a plane with a banner flying over the state capitol. But Jay Cope, the ethics panel, said, well, you're a lobbyist. You got to pay fines. And she has resisted that, saying, how can I benefit from this law? I already had my settlement. I'm not going to monetarily benefit from it. And she's somebody who's quite a fighter. She's not going to just quietly pay this you know, thousands of dollars in fines to the ethics panel, and now she's decided to take them to court, and we'll see the lobbying law, you know, could potentially be thrown out, or it could be upheld.
Lawmakers have questioned Jacob about this, and this week the governor's office finally weighed in and said, well, all we know about this is what we know from the media, despite the fact that Kat Sullivan sent the executive chamber a letter. Mm-hmm. But their response was there are greater matters that Jacob should be focused on.
Yeah, well, you pushed me into a position of defending a government agency, which I'll never forgive you for.
I hate to do that. I'm sorry.
JACOB, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics that handles lobbying, regulates lobbying and ethics in Albany, is in a bit of a tough situation. Lobbying is not an easy thing to define, although the law goes to great pains to try to do that. You end up with an argument of, is it free speech or is it lobbying? And remember why the lobbying laws are there is because there was so much corruption of people who were lobbying, spending a lot of money on behalf of candidates on efforts, on policy, on spending. And that's what they're trying to rein in. So it's a difficult issue.
Okay, but it does seem like they could use a little discretion here.
Yes, they have
maybe
limited resources.
Yes.
All right, well, that is where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio and Mike Gormley of Newsday.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org and join us next week. We'll be taking a look at the vaping crisis. Will New York ban flavored vaping products? And will the state and country see more vaping-related illness? We'll take a look. I'm Ray Suarez. This is New York Now.